Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Harvard and affirmative action. And Richard, there is a lawsuit right now from a group of Asian American students against Harvard. They're suing the university, claiming that Harvard has been engaged in systematic discrimination against them and other Asian applicants. And the argument they're making is that the Asian students who are applying to Harvard outperform everyone else on the hard metrics that you'd look to in the admissions process, standardized tests, grades in high school, but that the admissions team at Harvard consistently downgrades them on a bunch of softer subjective measures. These are things like their personality or their likability. And they do this complaint alleges, to keep the overall number of Asian matriculants in any given class lower than it would otherwise be. So before we start getting into the ins and outs of this specific case, we should probably, just in order to give listeners a sort of roadmap to this episode, how you think about these issues, start off with the fact that you are a little bit more ambivalent on the affirmative action questions than at least a lot of your fellow travelers on the right. Explain to us where that comes from.
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing to state is I've always been extraordinarily uncomfortable and indeed have rejected the notion that an anti-discrimination law should apply to any private institution that has competitors. So in my view, it's not that anti-discrimination doesn't have a place in the law, but the place is confined to two type situations. One is to governments, I think, which have a duty to be even-handed with respect to all of their citizens, both on the way in which they tax them and the way in which they distribute their benefits, and also to a group of very important institutions known as public utilities and common carriers. And these essentially have a monopoly type position in a given industry. And if they were able to exclude one group of people, these people would never be able to get any service whatsoever. And if you can't exclude people, then you cannot give them terms of service that are so unfavorable that it's tantamount to a rejection of their custom. And so the rule that is generally developed there is called the Frand rule, which means that when you're dealing with public utilities and common carriers, the rates that you charge people must be fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. And the protection that goes there is not only with respect to the rates that are charged, but also has to go to the equalization of the quality of services that are going to be given. It gets kind of complicated when the cost of service is higher to some groups than to other groups, say because of the time at which they demand it or at the location in which they live. But let us say, just for the sake of argument, that even when you take those things into account, what you cannot do when you're the only person who provides a given service is to turn people down either explicitly or by these various kinds of disguises, and you can't sub them to more adverse terms. Harvard is not a common carrier. It doesn't supply electricity or train service. It's supposed to be a distinguished institution of higher learning. It's also in competition with Lord knows how many other institutions and so forth. So as a matter of first principle, I don't think that they should have to yield to any federal government mandate as to who comes in and who doesn't come in. Now, this often puts me at odds with many people who are on the sort of libertarian side of the fence, many of whom, like, say, for example, Tom Sowell, have always believed that there has to be a powerful colorblind principle inside these institutions. And I certainly have no objection to any institution that privately wishes to adopt exactly that position. But by the same token, I'm not so sure that the only thing that matters in choosing a collectivity is senses of individual merit, that I'm going to leave these institutions the ground to choose their body on whatever grounds they want. Now, this is going to make it very easy, for example, for religious groups to decide that they're going to operate on religious grounds. It also makes it very possible for same-sex schools, female schools and male schools, to continue to operate by excluding the others. What's happened, in fact, in this particular area is that all these schools that were single-sex were grandfathered, but no new single-sex school could come up. And if, in fact, you are single-sex, male single-sex in particular, like Wabash College, the moment you admit one woman, it turns out that what you have to do is to basically give up your single-sex status. I think all of these kinds of restraints are crazy. because the variety of private institutions and the values that they serve is manifold, and the anti-discrimination laws are blind to all these kinds of differences. So if Harvard wants to do all of this stuff, I think it's fine. And I'll add just one other point. If they were allowed to do this explicitly, I don't think they would have to engage in sort of subtle forms of group defamation. They can say, we think there are huge numbers of excellent Asian students, but in order to keep some kind of balance on the campus on ethnic ground, what we want to do is to take fewer than we might have done if the only thing that mattered was merit. And if they did that, it would be an entirely different kind of discourse. People can still argue whether or not they should take 22% Asians, 25% Asians, none at all. But what they would not have to do is to try to justify this by a series of arguments, which I think are just plain transparently false. And so within the framework of a categorical statute, which prevents all of this, what Harvard has to do is to duck and to jump and to hide. And in an effort to do those things, I think quite often it looks rather ridiculous in the way in which it presents itself to the public.
I want you to explain that categorical statute that you just referenced. So you just laid out your sort of first principles on this. Explain to us how the law differs from those principles. From whence does this potential legal liability around how Harvard does its admissions work come from? As a private institution, why are they not free to simply admit or not admit whomever they want?
Well, the pivotal act in American civil rights law, now 54 years ago, was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And at that particular time, two things I think were true. One is there were many private institutions, particularly in the South, and ostensibly they had freedom to deal with whomever they wanted. But if you looked in the South, there was never any entry of any institution that was willing to integrate. I think the best explanation for it, frankly, was a combination of two things. One, there was a lot of private violence, which would be lodged against any black institution that took white students or any white institutions that took black students. So there was private force, which means that you're not in a competitive market. You're in some kind of a jungle. And also, under those particular circumstances, you had organized state policies which prevented these groups from coming in. My best guess on how it works is in order for you to open up anything, you have to connect to the electric and the gas companies. And if the state that run these things decide to shut you down or slow down your service, you can't survive. So oddly enough, since every private business has to attach to a common carrier, you can enforce segregation quite silently by simply giving differential terms of service. And then when they start to sue you, you turn it on again, and then you say, oh, it's broken again, and so forth. Because there's no way, given the enormous demand for integration by all sorts of organizations, that the South would remain fully segregated if free entry were allowed. And so people sort of understood this, and what they did in the 1964 Act is stopped what they regarded, rightly, as a series of egregious injustices. And this was done at a time where a second point is important. There is not any particular affection for competitive markets that existed at the height of the New Deal. There's no affection for competitive markets in the middle of the Great Society. And so these folks don't think that you're giving up very much when you stop using the form of organization that gives us all intellectual energy. And one of the ways that Hubert Humphrey put the point, he said, look, we managed to pass a minimum wage law. Why can't we pass a civil rights law? And there was nobody who sort of looked at him and said, you know, Hubert, you're wrong about the minimum wage law. And if, in fact, he is right about the minimum wage law, this is even worse. And so it goes through. And so what there was kind of acclamation for saying that we want all of this stuff. And in fact, the great battle at the time was over affirmative action or preferential treatment, as it was called. And the way in which the debate took place, and I could still remember these debates because I was in college at the time following it all, was people said, well, you know, we don't want to go from segregation to preferences for black students coming in. So what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that this thing is colorblind, a colossal mistake in my judgment. And this is what the statute, Title VI, says. No person, that means any person, right, in the United States shall, on the grounds of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance, which includes, of course, Harvard University. So this is absolutely categorical in these terms. And in 1964, everybody believed in that. By 1966, we had 2 years of race riots, and most people are now completely uncertain as to whether this is the sensible strategy and start pushing very hard for affirmative action program. But if you look at the statute, they're not allowed. And it took the, shall we say, the genius pen of Justice William Brennan in a case called Weber, decided around 1979 or so, in which he just misread the statute to allow affirmative action program because he changed it in the following way. No person shall be denied benefits for or subject to invidious discrimination. Put that word in there. And what we want to do is not invidious. So what they did is essentially they rewrote the statute to allow affirmative action programs, but they were going to be mainly in favor of African Americans, not in favor of Asians, who really weren't much on the scene then, given that this was over 50 years ago. And now when it comes up, what everybody thought was a necessary corrective is an absolute noose around Harvard's neck. They can't get out of it. And so what you do is you see somebody saying, look, the law is the law. And the striking irony of this is the last people in the world who would make an argument that Title VI is a mistake and that we should repeal the Civil Rights Act insofar as it applies to competitive labor markets and so forth would be Harvard University. And so what they have to do is they have to dissemble. And they're frankly not very good at it.
So tell me about that dissembling. You wrote a piece about this for Defining Ideas recently, and at one point you refer to Harvard's efforts in this case as, and I'm quoting you here, a mess of self-righteous conceptual and factual confusions that make Harvard look like an institutional laughingstock. This is pretty tough stuff, Richard. What are they getting wrong in this case?
Everything. So look, the conceptual stuff, the first thing what they want to do is they want to state, look, I mean, we can't run our institution if we're going to be bound by these particular principles. And so that seems to say that they think they're justified in deviation from the basic command, but for reasons that are explicitly rejected by the statute. So then they turn around and say, well, we're not engaged in intentional discrimination at all. So they're repeating in this context the old kind of joke which says, Your Honor, I didn't kill him, but if I did, it was in self-defense. You can't play the game that way. They are very clear that they're doing discrimination. It's intentional. They think it's desirable. But what they have to do is to deny that it's happening and then explain why they're right to do it in that particular fashion. So when it comes up in this particular way, it looks, frankly, vaguely kind of ridiculous that they should try to walk on both sides. But this is Harvard, and so they do it with a kind of intellectual arrogance in which they say, if we're a great university and we say something that's dumb, all you lesser people out there in the world have to take us at our word. And so what their kind of whole opinion is in this case is, we're Harvard, we're right. Who are these lowlifers who are going to try to attack them? In the meantime, even on the statistical analysis, which is the second point, they're constantly being pushed back in all sorts of ways. You first have to understand you don't get any numbers in the Harvard brief, but if you go and you check around and you see what's going on with respect to Asian students and African-American students, what you discover is Asian students are much larger than their proportion of the general population, but so are African-American students. But the scores that you get on the boards are probably 300 or 400 points different. And the question is, why do you have to have that difference? Because that's just the way the numbers come out if you start looking at the medians and the variances on these two systems. So what Harvard does is say, we're going to start looking at all these personality things. Generally speaking, the way you do this, if you want to get it right, is what you do, you take your first tier of people on the boards and grades, so very high, and you got more people in that group that you can possibly admit. And then within that very narrow group of people with perfect gourds, honors, and all the rest of this stuff, you know, winning the Westinghouse Prize or whatever, what you do is you say, well, we can take them all. We'll take the ones we think are better. Harvard doesn't do that. What it does, in effect, is at least with the African Americans, it goes down 2 or 3 tiers. And then having gotten 2 or 3 tiers, it treats everybody who gets over this cutoff line as equal, and then it puts all this soft stuff into the mix. And what the Asian students pointed out, which distresses Harvard, is that was exactly what was done in the 20s and 30s by Harvard with respect to Jewish applicants. And they were quite explicit about it. We don't want to have the place overrun by a New York Jews, of which I happen to be one. And, you know, Harvard says, you can't introduce that as evidence. And they're not introducing it as evidence. What they're introducing it as a way of explaining how it is when you start having soft stuff. It doesn't allow you to qualify the hard stuff. it allows you completely to ignore it. I've done a lot of admissions work over the years, and this is the basic rule of thumb. The people who are really strong on boards and grades, it's from that group that you're going to find the strongest students with respect to personality, extracurricular activities, and everything else that starts to go on. So if you were doing this on a race-blind basis, what would happen is you look to that stuff, the gaps wouldn't get smaller. They would probably get somewhat larger. And my view is if Harvard wants to take African-American students who are weaker, want to take athletes, want to take alumni, they don't have to explain it to me. But given the way in which Title VI is organized, they have to explain it to the Asian students and to federal district court in Massachusetts. So I think they're wrong on the law. We could talk later if you want about some of the statistical stuff. But their analysis there was essentially very bad. And a bunch of independent econometricians wrote this nice brief explaining all the places in which they had done everything completely wrong. It's a kind of a sad show. And, you know, I hope they win abstractly, and I think they deserve to lose under the current law.
Talk to me about the broader conceptual underpinnings of this, Richard. As you suggested earlier, the idea of affirmative action is certainly not new, but the focus on diversity has, I think it's fair to say, taken on a new intensity on college campuses over the past few years. There are a lot of folks, especially on the right, who think that it has become a malign force. What's your view?
I am all in favor of diversity in the traditional sense of that word, which is you try to get people together in an institution, have different points of view, different backgrounds, and see how they interact with one another. But what's happened is diversity, inclusion, and belonging have become code words for people who essentially believe that certain things matter and certain things that don't matter. And the things that don't matter are intellectual diversity and changes in political points of view. So Harvard has become completely monolithic at the academic level. Every one of the deans and the organizations are all strong, hard left types. And, you know, here I am, a libertarian conservative. I'm not a religious conservative and so forth. But it's not as though they want to include people like myself in their particular discourse. They may do it at some level. You know, we'll take one or two. But if you try to look at objective measures of what's going on, you'd get a very different picture. So one of the things that I would love to see done with respect to Harvard and other schools that practice the same thing is to ask, well, you've got an admissions committee. What's their political coloration? And my guess is you will find that they're very strong champions of diversity, because every single word that has come out of Harvard from an official position has always stressed these words over and over again. You might recall a year or two ago where there was this big fight over the finals club, and they were told very certainly that diversity and inclusion is so important that no club on or off campus can house any Harvard students unless they're co-ed. Now, I regard that as frankly ridiculous. I mean, if you really want to change people to develop in the world, one of the things that you want to teach them is how it is that they can function in different kinds of groups in different sorts of ways. So, you know, I do not think it is immoral that my wife is in a women's book club to which I am rousingly not invited. I think it's perfectly appropriate that they want to do this thing. And if, you know, men want to form some kind of a club so that they play poker and they don't want women in it, I'm not going to get particularly upset about that. The key thing to understand is that if any individual were to say, I will only join women's organizations or I will only join men's organizations and so forth, that would be an incredible slap in the face because it indicates that they can't move in multiple circles. The trick of a mature person is to be able to do same stuff things and same sex things and other things that are integrated in different ways. When I started teaching back in 1968, the thing that I had to learn most about was being comfortable with age disparities. There I was, 25 years old, and what am I supposed to do when I meet some eminent professor who's twice my age, written a bunch of articles, and I realized very early on that you have to approach them as a colleague rather than as a supplicant or as a student. Otherwise, you've given up all of your intellectual independence as a faculty member. And now that I'm on the other end of this thing, I have exactly the same view. I can't talk at 75 years of age to people who are 25 years older than I am, but I can talk to people who are 25 years younger and 40 years younger. And the last thing you want to do on this stuff is to kind of feel as though the age differences create some kind of barrier with respect to discourse. And of course, age discrimination is forbidden under these various statutes. It has wrecked the tenure position at most major universities, again, because the government knows best and private people can't do anything in order to resist this. So the thing where you have to understand this is all of these various statutes, to some extent inconsistent. You have the race, you have the age, you have the sexual orientation, you have the handicap, religious affiliation. And the government is trying to juggle them all from afar. And what you have to understand is that the old Hayekian insight that private institutions have better knowledge of their local conditions and their internal demands than anybody sitting in Washington or, frankly, anybody wanting to sue them. But that point is completely gone from modern discourse. And when you start hearing the discussions on these things, there's a kind of an absolutist tone. And my favorite illustration of the silliness of this all comes from Harvard itself, when it talked about its finals club, that is the off-campus residences for upper division students. And it says, if they are not co-ed, we will not let them come, we will not let their students get letters of recommendation from us. But my favorite was, if you're not co-ed, we will not allow anyone who is in a non-co-ed club become the captain of a single-sex team. But that's exactly what the point is. Nobody wants to get rid of single-sex teams. It makes absolutely no sense for athletics and so forth. And yet there you have another one of the great mistakes, which is in Title IX, of forcing all schools to have equalization of resources in single-sex teams, which has led to shutting down tens and dozens of men's swimming teams and wrestling teams and so forth, so as to make the place free for professional football, or the college football, same thing perhaps. And once you understand that women and men are not the same when it comes to sports, you realize that the equality constraint is going to require you again to do all sorts of fiction. And then when you start looking at programs, it's not as though it's discrimination by the institution, which means that 97% of the people who want to study naval architecture are male, and 88% of the people who want to study social services and social work turn out to be female. You can't sort of pretend that it's only institutions driving the distinctions. You have to recognize that individual people, grouped by sex, perhaps even by race, have different preferences and tastes. And your job as an institution is to bring out the best in all of these individuals rather than to use this value of diversity, inclusion, and equality to say every time you see an imbalance along one of these dimensions, you're suspicious about the entire process. And so I regard this as a kind of a modern tragedy. And I really think that Harvard will reduce itself to a second-tier institution to the extent that it can continues to hammer on all these things. I'm going to put it the way I say in many other contexts, and perhaps end on this note. I'm saying generally, if you're searching for diversity, what you're going to get is mediocrity. If you're searching for evidence in today's society, you're going to get diversity. The difference is it's going to be a very different kind of diversity that you get under the iron fist of places like Harvard University.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.